from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The online giant Amazon has been reshaping the retail world for nearly 20 years. Whether it was a book or a CD, people discovered they could get it on Amazon for less. Indeed, that phrase, get it on Amazon, has had a profound impact on American commerce that goes well beyond books and CDs. From shopping for new tools to new toys, computing services to delivery systems, you can get it on Amazon. The Amazon Economy is the title of a new book by Barney Jobson. He'll join us in the hour ahead as we take up how Amazon is changing American commerce. That's our topic, and you can get it on Public Radio. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's beginning to look a lot like Amazon. That's because Amazon is where you can get great stuff, holiday or otherwise, at bargain prices, delivered to your door fast. In less than two decades, Amazon has transformed American shopping. Some 85 million Americans visit Amazon each month. Booksellers have had their world transformed by Amazon twice, first in terms of book pricing, and then, of course, with the advent of e-books. Today, Amazon is the buyer's conduit to just about any product, but the company's impact goes well beyond what we buy. It goes to actually the infrastructure of American commerce, from financial services to computing systems. How America has been transformed, both in the ways in which we buy and the ways in which we consume, makes for a fascinating tale, one that is told in a new book, an e-book, of course, called The Amazon Economy. The author is Barney Jobson, a correspondent for Financial Times, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Hello. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Explain the title, Amazon Economy, because it is now so much more than just how we might go buy a book that we're looking for. What drew you to this global force?
Well, what we realized was that there are four big tech giants today in the US. There's Amazon, there's Google, there's Facebook, and there's Apple. And we felt that the other three had got a lot of attention, a lot of scrutiny, and that Amazon was less understood and less analyzed. And I think one reason for that is that what Google and Facebook and Apple are doing is a lot more cool, it's a lot more attractive, it's a lot more fun. Amazon's all about infrastructure, systems, delivering things. It's a lot less exciting, but it's actually, in some ways, a lot more important than what the other companies are doing. So the origin of the title of the book is this recognition that whereas Amazon is perhaps still primarily known as an online retailer, that online retail business is just the tip of the iceberg. What it's actually done is turned all of its systems inside out and enabled other companies to rent out parts of its website, to rent out its warehouses, to use its customer support system. So beyond selling products itself, which it still continues to do, it's also almost become like a utility company on which lots of other businesses depend. And that gives it a level of power and influence which really surpasses those other tech giants that we know so well.
Before we climb into that utility company and that infrastructure, you would then make the argument that it's more appropriate to have a book titled The Amazon Economy, rather, that's a more significant subject than the Apple economy or the Google economy, that the influence of Amazon really surpasses those other tech giants?
It's difficult to quantify these things, but that's certainly the argument we're making. If you look at the range of businesses that Amazon's extended into, it really goes beyond the others. Just to list a few, we've got cloud computing, we've got warehousing, customer service, it's now making movies, it's making TV shows, it's getting into the publishing business, so it's not only selling books, it's also printing books, it's getting into high fashion. So it's become a diversified internet conglomerate in a way which some of its rivals have not.
Describe the web part of this in particular, the cloud computing, what Amazon is now doing, because it's not something I was aware of, that it is making available its vast computing resources. How does that work and how does that contribute to its overall influence in our economic system?
So if you think about the way traditional businesses operate, the traditional IT guys, you'll find IT technicians who are based in most company offices. They're running servers which are based in the offices of those companies. That's the way it's worked for a long time. What Amazon is saying is that, hey, that's not the most efficient way to do things. You're spending a lot of time and a lot of money maintaining these servers, maintaining these systems, when that's not your area of expertise. Your business is something else. So why don't you let us at Amazon manage those systems for you? Why don't you outsource all your IT functions to our servers, which will be based in other parts of the country, and leave our engineers to maintain them and fix any problems that might arise? If you do that, you can lower your costs, and you can focus on your area of speciality. And there are lots of businesses that have been persuaded by this argument. Netflix, a big movie streaming company that we know, runs most of its operations on Amazon servers. Airbnb, which is a company that lets you rent rooms while you're traveling around, also runs largely on Airbnb. The Guardian newspaper group also uses some of their systems. So
MIT does as well, right?
Right, that I'm not sure of that, but that could be true. So Amazon's systems are underpinning a whole range of businesses which gain the benefit of efficiency, lower costs, but there is a downside. There could be a downside. They're now dependent heavily on what Amazon's doing. And one of the questions we raise in the book is about the tension between the efficiency and the cost benefits you get from signing up into the Amazon economy, and what you're giving away in terms of autonomy and independence. Because, of course, if you're running on Amazon systems and Amazon decides to change the prices, well, you've got to follow that. As it happens, Amazon has been lowering its prices, and that's good, and they lowered their prices again this week. But if your business is entirely based on their systems, then you're vulnerable to the decisions that they make.
So in a sense, Amazon is really infiltrated, if that's the right word, across a wide variety of American businesses. It's much more now than the place where you go to get a book or whatever it happens to be. It really plays a fundamental role in the way in which American commerce functions.
Absolutely. One of the phrases we use in the book is the idea of colonizing the infrastructure of consumption. Now, Amazon's a secretive company, so they don't share what their long-term vision is. But if you look at everything they're doing, what I think's happening is that they're trying to build a business which can be positioned to be involved in every transaction that happens via the internet, whether that's somebody buying a book or somebody running their movie streaming service. The strategy seems to be that Amazon will be involved in providing some kind of support to that company. And when a transaction happens, it can take a little piece of that. It can take a little fee. And if it does that, if it succeeds in kind of broadening itself so it's involved in everything, then it's got a very stable, solid business model that will deliver a nice, steady stream of income. Because whenever anything happens, it's getting a little benefit.
Barney Jepson is our guest. He's a correspondent for Financial Times, did a series about Amazon for Financial Times, and that's now been compiled into an ebook called Amazon Economy. It sounds like that Amazon really now has a piece of almost everything. Let me just offer one example that I experienced recently, which was running a Kickstarter campaign for a film project that I'm involved in. Amazon got a piece of that. Is that sort of the norm now, that no matter sort of what you do, Amazon winds up being involved?
They have a remarkable ability for popping up in all kinds of unexpected areas, and many of them do seem to be a little bit incongruous. I mean, if we look at movie production, this is one interesting example, because, you know, Amazon's core skill is using its technological expertise, its engineering know-how, its computer coding know-how to build systems that are fast, reliable, efficient, and low cost. So in movie production, in television production, how does that work? Those are two areas where creativity is at a premium. It's hard to see how Amazon can use its core skills to make a success of making movies, making TV shows. And the same questions hang over its move into fashion. It's trying to turn Amazon.com into a site where people will buy high fashion. And there's a lot of people in the fashion industry who are saying, well, hang on, This is not the kind of brand we want to be associated with. So there's definitely a gap between the idea of being a technology company all about efficiency and the idea of being a company which is producing or selling products which are all about creativity and softer skills. And I think it remains to be seen whether Amazon can successfully combine those two very different areas within one entity.
Let's go back to Amazon's origins and the philosophy that Jeff Bezos has maintained. One of the distinctive things about it that I'd like you to describe is that they operate on a very low profit margin, which is, of course, part of how they're able to price things so cheaply and make it possible for people to get books or whatever it happens to be, back to that earlier version of what how Amazon started. But describe what's behind that philosophy, how that works.
The Amazon approach is to sacrifice short-term profits in order to grow sales in the hope that those sales in the long term will enable it to make good money. And it's really an unusual company in the context of most of its rivals because investors, on the whole, have given it a buy there. They said, that's fine, okay, we don't want you to make profits. You don't have to prove to us that you can make profit. As long as you can keep your sales growing, and Amazon sales have been growing about 20 or 30% a year recently and are set to go over $60 billion this year. The investors say, as long as you can keep sales growing, we'll trust you. But they are putting a lot of trust into Amazon. And in the last quarter, it actually made a net loss. It lost money for the first time in 2003, but still, that didn't unnerve investors, which is a reminder of just how much the stock market believes in Jeff Bezos, Amazon's boss, and his vision. However, there are still a few skeptics out there, and they wonder whether Amazon is ever going to be able to make a profit, because the reason it made that last loss is it's in the middle of a big investment binge. It's investing in new warehouses for its distribution. It's investing in new servers for the cloud computing business we discussed. It's investing in its Kindle tablets and Kindle e-readers. So it's spending money on a whole host of things, and as a result, it hasn't made a profit. Now, there's a small minority of skeptics who say, well, in order to make it profit, it's going to have to stop this investment, and when it stops the investment, is that going to slow the growth? So there is a doubt there, but there is plenty of people who believe that Jeff Bezos, the boss, knows exactly what he's doing. It's just that he doesn't tend to share exactly what he's thinking with the rest of us.
Indeed, you note in your book, as I recall, that you never got Amazon to conduct an interview, that they never responded. I know when we tried to get an Amazon representative to participate in this interview today, we didn't get a response. How difficult are they to penetrate?
It is a very secretive company, and on the whole, they don't seem to see a lot of benefit in communicating with the press, except when it comes to moments when they're launching a new product or a new initiative that they want to get publicity for. But I wonder whether this is also going to change, because now they're taking on such power and importance in the world, and they are getting more attention. I think with that comes some obligations to be more communicative. And in my home country, the UK, Amazon has been the subject of some tough questions about their tax policy. And one of their executives was called in front of a hearing of British lawmakers recently and asked a host of questions, most of which he refused to answer or was unable to answer. And that resulted in the lawmakers getting very frustrated and very angry. And I think for a company that's becoming so big, that's not a tenable approach anymore. I think they're going to come under more and more pressure to open up, because with size does come some responsibility.
You referenced tax policy, and that's an interesting part of the Amazon story. For a long time, you didn't have to pay sales tax on purchases through Amazon because the rules in this country are such that unless you had an actual physical plant in a state like California, you didn't have to charge sales tax. A number of states, including California, have pushed back on that, trying to make sure that you did have to pay sales tax so that California could collect that revenue. And interestingly, Amazon isn't fighting that anymore. And there's a reason for that, because they actually now want to have some physical presence, and it has to do with what their priorities are. Describe where they're at with that and why they're no longer fighting those sorts of sales tax battles.
Yes, the company executed a remarkable U-turn on sales tax. They would deny that, but for a long time they were very resistant to the idea of collecting sales tax from consumers anywhere. And then last year they switched. In fact, in California, they'd fought an initiative to force them to collect sales tax, and then they changed their mind and said, OK, we'll start collecting it. And lo and behold, they did just in September this year. Now, there are two reasons for that. One is I think they saw that the wall of political pressure leaning over them was too foreboding, and that they would have to submit. But the other reason, I think, is that they saw how they could turn this to their advantage. And as you say, you have to collect sales tax in any state where you have a physical presence. But if Amazon now accepts that it's going to eventually have to collect sales tax anywhere, then there's no reason not to build new facilities across the US. And the new facilities it wants to build are warehouses. The more warehouses it has, the faster it can deliver products to you, the consumer. And the faster you, the consumer, can receive those products, the less reason you have to go to a bricks and mortar store. If you think about it, bricks and mortar stores are under a lot of pressure from online retailers. They have been for a long time. But one of the last advantages they have is immediacy, instant gratification. If you need to pick up a tube of toothpaste or some cough medicine for this evening, then you're going to go to the store on your way home. There's no point ordering it online if it's not going to arrive for 3 days. But if Amazon can get that toothpaste or that cough medicine to you in the space of a few hours, because they've built a warehouse just a few miles away from your home, well, then maybe you don't have any need to go to the bricks and mortar store anymore. So this change in tax policy has enabled it to accelerate its construction of warehouses, and that is going to pose an even more acute threat to bricks and mortar retailers.
And that's really central to their philosophy. You write about Jeff Bezos saying that he wants to basically focus on what will always be true, which is that people will always want things cheap. They'll always want a good selection, and they'll want it delivered fast. And that's sort of central to how they're going about forwarding their business in all of these different arenas, right?
That's right. He's got a very distinct philosophy on business, which is very interesting. And when I heard him make that comment, it was at an event where somebody asked him to predict the three big changes we're going to see in the world of technology in the next 10 years. And his answer was, well, I can't. Prediction is a mug's game. But what I can tell you is what's not going to change. And as you say, he said that people are always going to want low prices. They're always going to want reliable delivery. They're always going to want the broadest possible selection. So what he's done is build a business which is based on the things that are not going to change. Now, I think he probably does have a very clear idea about where he wants to take the business, which he's not sharing. He probably does have a few predictions about what's going to be important in the future and what is going to change. But because of the secrecy that we've mentioned, he's not willing to talk so openly about that.
And let's dig next then into how this plays out and the impact that it has on retailers. There's an impression, and talk about this if you would, Barney, but that Amazon has this kind of take no prisoners approach, that it is willing to do whatever it needs to do and doesn't mind if retailers go out of business at all. The apocryphal story that's often told is the one about the famous phone app that Amazon had, where you could go into a bookstore and use this phone app to do a little price check, use the store basically to browse, but then go buy that same book for a lower price on Amazon. And not only that, you would get an extra credit for having used that phone app. What does that say about their overall approach?
Well, firstly, the story is not apocryphal. It did actually happen last December. It was a real thing, and that underlined, in the eyes of many bricks and mortar retailers at least, just how ruthless Amazon is. And many of those traditional retailers feel, as you say, that Amazon is out to put them out of business. Now, Amazon's supporters would say that, no, it's not. It's not motivated by causing harm to anyone else. It's only motivated by taking technology and pushing it as far as it can go. The consequences of that are merely a side effect. I'm not sure that such a big company can absolve itself of responsibility for the side effects of what it does. But what we've already seen in the 17 or 18 years that Amazon's been in existence is that it's put an increasing amount of pressure on bricks and mortar stores. In the book business, we've seen Borders close down. In the electronics business, which is another important category online, we've seen Circuit City close down. Many large retailers are closing some of their stores. I think of Best Buy, of Sears, which have made those announcements because so much business has shifted online and so much business has shifted to Amazon that their stores are less productive, less attractive assets to have. And what's remarkable is that even though it can feel like Amazon is taking over, online retail is still only 10% of all retail in the US, and Amazon is about 20% of that 10%. So it feels like it's everywhere, but it actually represents only a small proportion of shopping. So there are two ways to look at that. One is that, well, we're exaggerating their influence. It's actually not that important at all. The other is to think, wow, well, if this is what the world feels like now, imagine what it's going to feel like, imagine what it's going to look like if online shopping is 20 or 30% of all shopping.
And describe how different parts of American enterprise are trying to push back. The book business is an interesting example of this. Because Amazon priced books so cheaply, ebooks in particular, the number of publishers joined with Apple to try to fight back, including Pearson, which is the owns Penguin, which also owns the Financial Times, we should say. So there is that connection to your work engaged with that. But what happened in that effort, and what will it say about how the publishing industry will work going forward?
Well, publishers were concerned that Amazon was reducing the prices of their books, and the allegation that came from the Department of Justice was that they were colluding to, in fact, raise the price of those books. And I'm not sure of the details of how that case has played out, but it seems to be that the Department of Justice has is inclined to a view of the world that Amazon would support, or that at least Amazon has benefited from. And Amazon has said that as a result of the allegations it's made, Amazon is ready to begin lowering prices all over again. So in that case, Amazon has not caused any trouble, it seems, in the eyes of the Department of Justice. So how publishers are going to react, I think, remains to be seen. The reaction of booksellers to Amazon is also very interesting. Now, Amazon is, in addition to selling books, as I mentioned, it's also beginning to publish its own books, which is a big threat to the publishing industry too. But in solidarity with those publishers, many booksellers in this country, traditional booksellers, including Barnes & Noble, have actually launched a boycott of Amazon books. So they're saying that they're not going to sell the printed books that Amazon is producing in retaliation, if you like, for its aggressive moves into publishing.
It doesn't seem, though, that Amazon feels terribly threatened. I mean, your book, which is, you know, makes its case about Amazon, is available on Kindle, right? So they don't seem terribly threatened by the sort of bright light that you are trying to place on them.
It's also available on Apple and the Barnes & Noble site, I should mention. But no, they would say that Amazon would say that they're merely focused on what's best for the customers. Now, I'm always a little bit skeptical about that. I think all businesses need to be aware of what their rivals are doing. But if we stick with the example of books, this boycott by the bricks and mortar stores could have an impact, because one of the reasons why authors would sign up with Amazon is that it offers very broad distribution. But if suddenly signing up with Amazon means that their books will not be available in a traditional bookstore, that may be a disincentive.
Yep.
So go on.
Yeah, sorry. Well, let's pick up on that point when we return. We have to take a short break. Barney Jobson joins us. His new book is The Amazon Economy. We'd like to hear your thoughts on Amazon. Do you use it? Are you concerned about the way in which it's reached out to so many aspects of the American economy? If you're a retail owner, how has Amazon affected you? We'd like to hear your thoughts on Amazon and its impact on the American economy at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. More on Amazon when we return. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Barney Jobson. He's a financial correspondent for the Financial Times and the author of a new ebook called The Amazon Economy. That's our topic this hour, the impact of Amazon on the American economy. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that subject. Do you use Amazon? Do you like it? Are you a retail store owner? How has Amazon affected you? 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can post your thoughts on our website as well or email them to us at forum@kqed.org. A couple of comments already coming in, Barney, that sort of summarize, I think, feelings about Amazon. Fred writes in, I've bought items for Amazon that turned out to be used, like a flash drive with someone else's music files on them, a scale with someone else's carpet fibers on it, and so on. Don't even think about buying clothing on Amazon. Mark writes, Amazon is the biggest propagator and profiteer of counterfeit products being manufactured and distributed by Asian countries. This online activity steals millions of dollars in jobs. And then there's Amir, who writes, Amazon is great. Service, prices, free shipping, no fuss, and most anything is available. It has done wonders for all the purchasing that I have done. So there is that sort of what you hear as well, Barney? It's sort of you get the full range of opinions about Amazon.
I think many consumers are in some ways conflicted about how they feel about Amazon. They appreciate the convenience, the selection, the low prices. But there's a growing awareness, I think, of the impact that Amazon's growth is having on the world in terms of the closure of bricks and mortar stores. There are questions about whether the environmental impact of online shopping is greater or less than traditional shopping when you think about the delivery trucks and all that stuff. So I think many consumers are not quite sure how to feel. They're torn in two different directions. But I think that the first two comments you read out there get us into one of the interesting elements of Amazon as an infrastructure business, which is that it's opened its website to other smaller retailers to sell products on Amazon.com as well. So when you look for a particular product, you'll see a whole host of buying options, and some will be new and some will be used, and they'll be from a variety of different retailers. Now, for those small retailers, this is, again, on the one hand, a great opportunity. Through Amazon, they're gaining access to a massive audience, something like 200 million registered customers. They're getting sales that they couldn't possibly get. But on the other hand, they're giving away some of that independence again. They're giving away some of their autonomy. And what some of the retailers that we've spoken to at the Financial Times have complained about is that when they find a product which is selling really, really well, is rising to the top of the sales rankings, they'll often see Amazon noticing that and Amazon beginning to sell that same product itself out of its own inventory, sometimes at a lower price. And when Amazon does that, it can take the sales away from the customers or the other retailers it's actually supporting.
So, in other words, if I'm a retail store owner and let's say I make, running shoes and this opens up the possibility of not just selling them out of my store but also online, Amazon noticed that my running shoes are doing really well. Amazon then jumps in and gets into that business. So that's they wind up because they have enormous access to shopping trends and data. I mean, they know everything about everyone, right?
They certainly know more about shopping trends in this country over the last decade than almost anyone else. And online, certainly they do. So they have a huge data advantage. And you've probably heard people talk about the importance of big data, about the importance of gathering all this data on various things, analyzing it, working out what's going on, making predictions about what's going on. Amazon is a master at that. And the example of it watching what some of its own small sellers are selling and then copying that is just another reminder of how that data kind of puts it at the head of the pack and enables it to stay ahead of everybody else.
Let's go to our calls. Hugh starts us out in Oakland this morning. Hugh, go ahead, please.
Hi. I think investors are crazy to invest in a company that's losing money, and it might be the last dot-bomb stock waiting to happen. But back to one of the points that your guest mentioned earlier, Amazon is buying up other online retailers in different areas across the country, from Zappos, who's actually quite big, to Fabrics.com. And in every category, they are undercutting the prices of their competitors, all to not earn a profit. And what I'm curious about, I thought there were laws against brick-and-mortar or online retailers undercutting other companies to put them out of business.
Hugh, thanks. Barney?
I think the law on undercutting is a little bit unclear, and it's very rare to see in retail any actual cases being brought based on those laws, whether it's in bricks and mortar or in online retail. It doesn't tend to happen. But the issue of the acquisitions of other companies is an interesting one. They bought Zappos, as you say. They've also bought soap.com, diapers.com. And this shows us that, you know, they really want to dominate online retail so that Amazon businesses become the only place you think of going if you're going to shop online. And if it succeeds in doing that, undercutting prices is not going to be an issue. The issue is going to be the fact that Amazon is going to have total control of prices. And one of the arguments that you hear from some of those investors who like the company is that in the fullness of time, when Amazon is really dominant, it's going to be able to raise its prices, and that's going to be how it can finally make a profit.
Which also raises the question of, as Hugh suggested, sort of legal and I would think regulatory concerns. I mean, to go back to your utility company analogy that you started this out with, Barney, if it's a big utility, ought there not be some regulatory framework that would be scrutinizing Amazon operations?
I've even heard an Amazon executive liken some of their cloud computing services to electricity companies. And yes, electricity companies, water companies that provide these basic services to so many other companies often do get regulated. So it's a question worth asking whether, if Amazon is to become this infrastructure business, whether there is a case for it to be regulated. Now, there's no discussion of that happening at the moment. Amazon says that it's not something that they really spend any time thinking about at all. But it is creating this unprecedented business model. So I think we have to ask, you know, How does society feel about a company that has that kind of importance?
Mary writes in, why isn't it being challenged as a monopoly? I thought we had laws about that. Is it getting regulatory scrutiny? Is it or political scrutiny in Washington?
The area where Amazon is most dominant is probably ebook sales, the sale of digital books, and it has a market share in the U.S. of about 60% or 70%. But what we saw in the Department of Justice case against those traditional publishers was that it was the actions of the traditional publishers that were causing concern for the Department of Justice, not Amazon. So there it seems that there isn't any concern about its dominance, and that's the area in ebooks where it has the largest market share. If you look at retail more generally, it's still a very small percentage of the entire retail market. So it's not at a level where I think that would trigger any more general concerns about its role in selling electronics or clothing or anything else.
Laura in Berkeley has our next thought. Laura, go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm calling in because I have an individual perspective that I'd like to share. I've been an Amazon customer for quite a long time. I'm an Amazon Prime member, and I am, and I use them probably, 15 times per month. But when I am buying a book, even though I'm an Amazon Prime member, which gives me free shipping for, you know, 2-day receipt, I will pay a little bit more. I'll pay $3 or $4 more to go through their reseller list, find one ideally for carbon footprint purposes on the West Coast, and buy that book from a local reseller somewhere else. I mean, they're not local to Berkeley, but they're local somewhere else. I even try to pick a reseller who's has a fewer positive, like 12,000 rather than 250,000 positive responses, because then I feel like they're probably a small operation. So
you use Amazon to browse for small retailers for books
absolutely.
In particular?
Yeah. And they make it very easy to do that now. But I am having to pay usually maybe $3 or $4 more for that book.
Yeah, Laura, thank you. Someone else wrote in something similar, Barney Jobson, that they use Amazon to browse and then they get it somewhere else or even go to the library. So there's a way you can sort of, I guess, use Amazon in a counterintuitive fashion.
Well, I think there are two points come out of that. One is that in many ways, Amazon is becoming the Google of product search.
Yeah.
If people want to look for something to buy on the internet, they don't start at Google now, they start at Amazon. But Laura's point is really interesting, and she mentioned that she made decisions based on her concerns about the carbon footprint of the order. And I think this is an issue which has not got enough attention and is going to get more and more attention. Just how environmentally friendly is it to buy something on Amazon and have it delivered to your door via a courier truck versus picking it up when you're out on a shopping trip? Now, there's no clear answer here. It's not clear what's better or worse. It all depends on the circumstances. If you live on an isolated farmstead and you're having a courier deliver you a single book in a single box, then that's probably slightly less good for the environment than you picking up that same book on your weekly shopping trip to the nearest town. However, if you live in the middle of a big town and a courier is dropping one package off to you along with 30 other packages to people who live on the same block, then that's a pretty efficient use of fuel. But it's not really a subject that's been debated. And when I did an interview with the head of Toys R Us in the last couple of weeks here at the FT, and he said that e-commerce is very ungreen, it stirred up a lot of controversy, a lot of strong opinions on both sides of the debate. And I think that's a discussion that we need to have. And it's interesting that Laura's already thinking about that herself as a consumer.
Laura, thanks so much for the call. Let's go next to John, who's joining us from Marin this morning. John, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to call in and get the guest's perspective on some of the correlations between this and the music industry, where you see sharp rise in sales of vinyl versus MP3s and everything like that. Obviously, it's not a huge impact, but it just seems like there's a trend towards making a product more personal on one end and just sort of connecting, and not in a retro way, but just sort of having art, having something more personal, having the product that you're buying have a little bit more meaning. And then on the other hand, when you talk about putting out brick-and-mortar businesses, in the Bay Area, we're lucky enough to have a lot of record stores and music stores that are sort of like a hub of culture where you can go in, if they're smaller, that is, not larger ones, where you can go in and you know who's working behind the desk and they can recommend something to you or tell you if there's something used in there that you sort of like. And I just, even though, and I really like the point you just made about Amazon being turning into the Google of products, I was curious what the what the guests' thoughts were on that in terms of pushing, you know, possibly making brick-and-mortar businesses that really are a hub of cultural activity and not just a cashier behind a desk.
Yeah, John, thanks. Thanks for the thought. So whether or not the future, I guess, for retail is in making things more personal, whether that's having vinyl, old-fashioned vinyl music recordings or doing – what have you learned about that, Barney, about ways in which retailers have kind of taken a personalized approach that can allow them to survive in this online world?
Well, I think the competition from Amazon is really raising the bar, if you like, for traditional retailers, for bricks and mortar retailers. And one way that they can keep on attracting customers to their stores is by offering good customer service. That's absolutely right. I think a problem in the retail sector is that a lot of stores don't offer that at all. There are either very few store associates available to ask questions of, or when you find someone and you ask a question, they don't know the answer, and you can actually find out the answer more efficiently yourself by searching online. So the bricks and mortar retailers need to get a lot better at customer service. They need to be able to offer you a friendliness or a kind of a usefulness that you can't find anywhere else in the world. And if we think about one of the more successful bricks and mortar retailers today, ironically, it's another technology company. It's Apple. Mm-hmm. The Apple stores are hugely popular and people like to go there because it's fun, it's informative, they like the staff. And that's why Apple is doing so well. Some of the traditional retailers don't have that. And if you're selling very simple commodity products, if you're a grocery store, if you're selling stuff like Walmart or Target, then it's very hard to kind of keep people coming in with the promise of a great experience because they can buy those things very easily online.
Ernst wants to challenge you in this email about the cloud computing services that Amazon offers. Ernst says, I've been a systems administrator for 20 years, and Amazon has managed to persuade lots of people, including your guests, that their service is something it is not. In any but the smallest, least demanding cases, Amazon is actually more expensive and less efficient than traditional server management. If you're not a real company, it's easy to get running on Amazon. But in all other cases, Amazon actually costs more, provides less power and slower access, and requires exactly the same level of expertise for systems people at the companies rather than using other solutions. So interesting. What's your response?
No, that's a great perspective to have, and I appreciate the insight. And I think that reminds us that, yes, whereas Amazon would tell us that the whole world is shifting to the cloud, there are plenty of businesses that will never do so. And one of the statistics that we have in the book is that still only 15% of all corporate IT functions are in the cloud, whether that's Amazon's cloud or somebody else's. So maybe that insight tells us that percentage is never going to rise to 100. So that's very interesting to hear.
CK wants to take up the question of Amazon's employment practices. CK writes, Amazon is in many ways even worse than Walmart. They employ next to no one in local communities, and to add insult to injury, they have almost no corporate giving. Say something, if you would, Barney, about employment practices. Amazon's been criticized for that, for working conditions. What can you tell us?
Amazon's business is built in large part on its network of warehouses. So it's created a huge amount of warehouse employment. And it's generated a lot of controversy, or it's attracted a lot of controversy over that, because various media organizations have done exposés of working conditions within warehouses, and they found stories of very demanding places to work, you know, high temperatures, a lack of air conditioning, little sympathy with employees who are injured or ill. So as a result of that, Amazon has developed a reputation. Whether it's justified or not is another question, but it's developed a reputation for its warehouses as difficult places to work, as tough places to work. Now, Amazon says in response to that if you look at the industry statistics, it's actually safer to work in one of our warehouses than it is to work in a department store. But what's beyond doubt is that warehouse employment is taking on a whole new level of importance due to the growth of e-commerce. And there's a lot of scrutiny there on just how good or bad working conditions in these warehouses are.
And the assertion by our emailer that Amazon doesn't do much in the way of corporate giving?
Amazon's local paper, the Seattle Times, did some stories on this earlier in the year, in which they accused it of not giving as much to the local community as some other Seattle-based businesses. I'm not sure what Amazon's response was to that. But again, this is a reminder that when you become a big company, you take on certain responsibilities, whether you like it or not. And I'm not sure whether Amazon has yet kind of grown up into those responsibilities.
Back to our call. Sydney in San Francisco is next. Sydney?
Hi, I'm an author. My first book sold pretty well in the traditional system. That was before Amazon took hold. And my second book, for a variety of reasons, I self-published. Its cover price was $15, and Amazon, which I very much needed to distribute it, sent me back $7 and change for each book they sold. I wrote it, I published it, I stored it, I conveyed it to them. It didn't get into their warehouse. They only sold them if they had an order. And I got 50%, which seems terribly unfair to me. And one more point. I use abebooks.com, which is a secondhand bookseller, for anything I need to get by mail if they've got it. And I, too, use Amazon as a reference page.
Sydney, thank you. What else have you heard, Barney, from authors about whether or not they're getting what they would like from Amazon?
Well, I think the question of whether that kind of cut is fair or not should be set in the broader context, or at least Amazon would try to set it in the broader context of access to a market. They would say, well, if you hadn't sold the book with us, how would you have got your your book to reach anyone. You know, mm-hmm. the audience for it could have been a lot smaller. So they would probably say that that 50% cut is quite fair, given the distribution that that Amazon's able to offer. But again, it brings us back to this broader point that, you know, there are financial benefits, there are marketing benefits to be gained from working with Amazon, but you're often sacrificing something as well.
Sydney, thanks for the call. On to Lee in Berkeley. Lee, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, there's so much complaining, and all of these people, I bet, use Amazon, and yet they have nothing but bad things to say. But more of concern to me is this widely held erroneous belief that live human interaction provides the best experience. And in my experience, that is completely untrue. Almost every time I shop in a brick-and-mortar outlet, I wish I hadn't. And that's why people go online. People infallibly, they're less knowledgeable, like your guest was saying. They are not often, you know, the mood isn't consistent. So, you know, retailers really need to stop romanticizing, and we need to stop romanticizing going into a bookstore and poking around, which I still do, and everyone should do, I guess, if, you know, they are so inclined. But, you know, I don't understand this, oh, precious attitude about going in and, you know, you must buy from the little bookstore on the corner.
Yeah. Lee, thank you for adding that. It's, and Shanti writes in something similar. I order everything I can on Amazon. As a city dweller who rarely drives, I prefer having things delivered to my house than taking a car trip to a big box store. I shop locally for specialty items, but I'm very unconcerned with Amazon's effect on bricks and mortar retailers. Those retailers have to compete on specialty products and service. If they can't, they should go out of business. So a little bit of not so romanticized view of retailers. And part of, on the question of customer service, Barney, that you write about is that from Amazon's point of view, their customer service is making sure you get the product you want and you get it fast. That's their definition, yeah?
Yeah, Bezos, Jeff Bezos, the company's boss, has an interesting perspective on that. He says that the best kind of customer service is when you don't need to talk to us, when you don't need to interact with a human being who works at Amazon, because the package arrives, it's fast, you get charged the price you were meant to be charged, and nothing goes wrong. So they're trying to remove the human element from the business of selling things. And for a lot of people, that's fine. It's absolutely right to remember that the reason we're talking about Amazon being such a big, powerful business is that lots of people have decided to do business with it, have decided to buy things from it. So there clearly is an audience of people who like that. And the number of bricks and mortar stores, to go back to the comment, the number of bricks and mortar stores that can offer good customer service to rival that, they really are in the minority, I think.
Lee, thanks for the call. Such an interesting idea, really, that, you know, removing the human element from sales transactions, that it can be viewed as a good thing. Rowan in Napa is next. Rowan, go ahead.
Hi, I'm in the wine business, and when you see Amazon entering the publishing business, and the publishers are all complaining about it, the only reason Amazon is able to enter businesses like book publishing and music publishing is because the publishers haven't done a great job. If you look at what the customer pays for the product and what the artist gets for the work, it's a very, very small ratio. And the publishing industry has left themselves wide open to competition, as has the music industry and the wine industry. And from a personal perspective, we use Amazon's cloud as a customer, so we run all of our IT on Amazon, and we actually compete with Amazon. So we sell wine to Amazon customers, and we probably sell more wine to Amazon customers than Amazon sells. So as far as the kind of evil empire theory, if that's what they're doing, they're not doing a very good job.
Rowan, thanks. So you're working it both ways, basically, yeah?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Rowan, thank you. Let's go next to Marty in Sunnyvale. Marty, go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for the opportunity. I'm glad you brought up the point on brick-and-mortar companies and the customer service that they provide. Let's take Apple, for example. I walked into Apple 3-4 times without buying anything. But eventually, at the end of the year, it made me buy a new product. So I think for brick-and-mortar companies, they not only provide the service for a brick-and-mortar company like Apple, they provided the service, and most of all, there's that atmosphere there. And people walk inside, they like the design of the store, they like the atmosphere. Even though they don't buy something, they end up buying something at the end. So I think Amazon dominating the Internet market, I think that's something that it's pretty much inevitable. And for brick-and-mortar companies, I think more emphasis should be on the service and the atmosphere and the experience that they provide for the customers. I want to hear if our host can
Marty,
talk
thank you.
A little bit on that. Yeah,
yeah, Marty, thanks. Thoughts, Barton Jobson?
I think that's absolutely right, that it's going to come down to the customer service. That's what's going to enable the successful bricks and mortar retailers to survive. But I do think that over the years to come, we're going to see a contraction, a reduction in the number of bricks and mortar stores and the number of bricks and mortar retailers, because not everybody is going to be able to carve out a meaningful, profitable niche for themselves. And just to go back to Rowan's point about the fact that the publishers that Amazon is challenging often weren't running the most efficient businesses, that's something that Amazon themselves have said. They said that, you know, we're all about trying to improve the efficiency of industries, and we target and disrupt industries where things could function more efficiently. And publishing was a famously sort of amateurish, erudite, but not always very financially disciplined business. So by coming into that business with their own technology, they're going to be able to reduce the prices of books. That's a good thing for consumers, at least consumers who want to buy the books Amazon is publishing. Remains to be seen whether that's going to be good for consumers who want to buy the books from the traditional, slightly inefficient publishing houses that may struggle to stay in business.
April writes in one last quick comment here that is worth noting. She says, people get confused between Amazon products and Amazon vendors. Usually when you get a defective product, it's because you've purchased from an Amazon vendor, not Amazon itself. When I purchase from Amazon itself, service is awesome and shipping is amazingly quick and dependable. It's an important point that there are various branches. And I guess in the end, just the last quick comment, that's so what's so interesting about Amazon. There's so many tentacles and branches to it.
Yeah, these vendors, which April refers to, are part of the broader ecosystem, part of the broader economy that Amazon has created. But Amazon is very aware, I think, that when one of those vendors provides bad service, it can damage the Amazon brand as well. So what some of the vendors tell me is that Amazon is watching them like a hawk. When they mess up, when they do something wrong, Amazon comes down on them like a ton of bricks, as they say. So it's really policing this economy as well, which is good for customers. Raises those questions about what happens to the independence of these businesses that have signed up with Amazon.
We'll have to leave it there. Barney Jobson, the new book is called The Amazon Economy. Thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thanks very much. A pleasure.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Danny Bringer is our engineer today. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. And Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. Michael Krasny will be back with you on Forum on Monday morning. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.